When we ended last night, Winston was at the 2 minute hate, and the crowd had been worked into an absolute fever. And after the face of Goldstein faded, the face of Big Brother appeared, and again moved the crowd into a frenzy. And then that face faded away, and the three slogans of the party stood out in bold capitals: "War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength." But the face of Big Brother seemed to persist for several seconds on the screen, as though the impact that it had made on everyone's eyeballs was too vivid to wear off immediately. The little sandy-haired woman had flung herself forward over the deck, over the back of the chair in front of her. With a tremulous murmur that sounded like, "My Savior," she extended her arms toward the screen. Then she buried her face in her hands. It was apparent that she was uttering a prayer. At this moment, the entire group of people broke into a deep, slow, rhythmical chant of "Be, be, be, be," over and over again, very slowly, with a long pause between the first "be" and the second, a heavy, murmurous sound, somehow curiously savage, in the background of which one seemed to hear the stamp of naked feet and the throbbing of tom-toms. For perhaps as much as 30 seconds they kept it up. It was a refrain that was often heard in moments of overwhelming emotion. Partly, it was a sort of hymn to the wisdom and majesty of Big Brother. But still more, it was an act of self-hypnosis, a deliberate drowning of consciousness by means of rhythmic noise. Winston's entrails seemed to grow cold, and the two-minute hate he could not help sharing in the general delirium, but this subhuman chanting of "be, be, be, be" always filled him with horror. Of course, he chanted with the rest. It was impossible to do otherwise. To dissemble your feelings, to control your face, to do what everyone else was doing was an instinctive reaction. But there was a space of a couple of seconds during which the expression of his eyes might conceivably have betrayed him. And it was exactly at this moment that the significant thing happened, if indeed it did happen. Momentarily, he caught O'Brien's eye. O'Brien had stood up. He had taken off his spectacles and was in the act of resettling them on his nose with his characteristic gesture. But there was a fraction of a second when their eyes met, and for as long as it took to happen, Winston knew, yes, he knew, that O'Brien was thinking the same thing as himself. An unmistakable message had passed. It was as though their two minds had opened and the thoughts were flowing from one into the other through their eyes. "I am with you," O'Brien seemed to be saying to him. "I know precisely what you are feeling. I know all about your contempt, your hatred, your disgust. But don't worry, I'm on your side." And then the flash of intelligence was gone, and O'Brien's face was as inscrutable as everyone else's. That was all. And he was already uncertain whether it had happened. Such incidents never had any sequel. All that they did was to keep alive in him the belief or hope that others besides himself were the enemies of the party. Perhaps the rumors of vast underground conspiracies were true after all. Perhaps the Brotherhood really existed. It was impossible, in spite of the endless arrests and confessions and executions, to be sure that the Brotherhood was not simply a myth. Some days he believed it, some days not. There was no evidence, only fleeting glimpses that might mean anything or nothing. Snatches of overheard conversation, faint scribbles on lavatory walls. Once, even, when two strangers met, a small movement of the hand, which had looked as though it might be a signal of recognition. It was all guesswork. Very likely he had imagined everything. He had gone back to his cubicle without looking at O'Brien again. The idea of following up their momentary contact hardly crossed his mind. It would have been inconceivably dangerous, even if he had known how to set about doing it. For a second, 2 seconds, they had exchanged an equivocal glance, and that was the end of the story. But even that was a memorable event in the locked loneliness in which one had to live. Winston roused himself and sat up straighter. He let out a belch. The gin was rising from his stomach. His eyes refocused on the page. He discovered that while he sat helplessly musing, he had also been writing as though by automatic action. and it was no longer the same cramped, awkward handwriting as before. His pen had slid voluptuously over the smooth paper, printing in neat, large capitals, "Down with Big Brother, down with Big Brother, down with Big Brother, down with Big Brother, down with Big Brother," over and over again, filling half a page. He could not help feeling a twinge of panic. It was absurd, since the writing of those particular words were not more dangerous than the initial act of opening the diary, but for a moment he was tempted to tear out the spoiled pages and abandon the enterprise altogether. He did not do so, however, because he knew that it was useless. Whether he wrote "Down with Big Brother," or whether he refrained from writing it, made no difference. Whether he went on with the diary, or just he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same. He had committed, would still have committed, even if he had never set pen to paper, the essential crime that contained all others in itself. Thought crime, they called it. Thought crime was not a thing that could be concealed forever. You might dodge successfully for a while, even for years, but sooner or later they were bound to get you. It was always at night. The arrests invariably happened at night. The sudden jerk out of sleep, the rough hand shaking your shoulder, the light glaring in your eyes, the ring of hard faces round the bed. In the vast majority of cases, there was no trial, no report of the arrest. People simply disappeared, always during the night. Your name was removed from the registers. Every record of everything you had ever done was wiped out. Your one-time existence was denied and then forgotten. You were abolished, annihilated. Vaporized was the usual word. For a moment, he was seized by a kind of hysteria. He began writing in a hurried, untidied scrawl. "They'll shoot me. I don't care. They'll shoot me in the back of the neck. I don't care. Down with Big Brother. They always shoot you in the back of the neck. I don't care. Down with Big Brother." He sat back in his chair, slightly ashamed of himself, and laid down the pen. The next moment, he started violently. There was a knocking at the door. "Already?" He sat still as a mouse, in the futile hope that whoever it was might go away after a single attempt. But no, the knocking was repeated. The worst thing of all would be to delay. His heart was thumping like a drum, but his face, from long habit, was probably expressionless. He got up and moved heavily toward the door. And if you're following along, that ends chapter one. And as you know, the book is divided, if I remember right, the books are divided into three or four sections. And that was the end of chapter one in the first section. And tomorrow night, we begin with chapter two. And again, the idea here is I'm going to continue to read a section or a segment of this every night on this program until one of three things happens. We complete the novel in its entirety. Bush is driven from office. Or I'm no longer with Air America. Now, of course, when we take time off, which we surely will, whoever substitutes for me, and it'll probably be Peter Werby, I would imagine, or whoever. The readings, of course, will not continue during that brief hiatus, but That's the plan.